I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. President-elect Joe Biden has announced some key appointments to his administration, and he has stepped up his public pleas for the Trump administration to ascertain the election and to allow his team access to government data about the coronavirus, vaccine development, and distribution plans, as well as high-level intelligence. NPR political correspondent Asma Khalid joins me with an update. And as COVID-19 cases surge throughout Maryland and the United States, local school officials are dialing back their plans to open schools for in-person learning. Dr. Daryl Williams, the superintendent of the Baltimore County School System, and Dr. Sonia Sonalesis, the CEO of Baltimore City Schools, discuss who's in school buildings now, who's being asked to stay home, and why. Midday starts right after the news. Good afternoon and welcome. It's Midday. Thanks for being with us. I'm Tom Hall. Yesterday at a press conference in Annapolis, Governor Larry Hogan gave a somber summary of the scope of the COVID-19 pandemic in Maryland. Some hospitals in western Maryland are at or near capacity. For three of the last 5 days, the state has reported more than 2,000 new cases, as the country sees new infections surpass 140,000 every day. Hogan said that the Department of Health's highest priority is to make sure that hospitals throughout the state are not overwhelmed. Hospital capacity is up 100% since the first of this month. He announced that most visitors will no longer be allowed in hospitals and nursing homes until further notice, and he encouraged hospitals to avoid any elective procedures that are not urgent. Hogan announced that effective Friday, all bars and food establishments will be required to close at 10 o'clock p.m. This decision is based on the fact that compliance with coronavirus protocols tends to diminish substantially after 10. The governor stressed, with no effort to hide his anger, that compliance must improve and that local jurisdictions must do more to enforce the orders to wear masks and physically distance. Hogan said that retail businesses, fitness centers, religious institutions, and other establishments will revert back to phase 2 capacity restrictions as well. A reminder, masks are required at all indoor facilities throughout the state and in any outdoor setting in which physical distancing is not possible. Mr. Hogan announced that tomorrow he will take part in a governor's call with President-elect Joe Biden and his transition team. And yesterday, amid encouraging news about not one but two promising vaccines, President-elect Joe Biden again called on the Trump administration to ascertain the election and begin sharing information about distribution of vaccines when they are ready. Joining me now is Asma Khalid. She's a political correspondent for NPR and a co-host of the NPR Politics podcast. She's covered the Biden campaign, and she's now covering the transition. Asma, welcome to the show. Thanks for your time.
Happy to be here. Thank you all for having me.
So you did a story about the appointments that President-elect Biden announced yesterday. Any surprises in the group?
You know, not particularly, though I will say I was intrigued to see his campaign manager, Jen O'Malley Dillon, actually take a job in the White House. She's known as a Democratic operative, pretty well-known Democratic operative who's worked on previous campaign cycles. So it was interesting to see her decide to take a job in-house within the Biden administration. But really what we saw there was kind of a mix of longtime aides and operatives and people who either were with the campaign from the early days of it, or frankly, even some folks that we saw like Steve Ricchetti, who've just been longtime close aides to Biden for many, many years.
Cedric Richmond, congressman from Louisiana, will join the administration. One of the effects of that is that the Democrats will lose, at least for a little while, another Democrat in Congress. So Speaker Pelosi, and she was nominated again by the Democrats, as well as Steny Hoyer from here in Maryland, to be part of the leadership team for the Dems. They're going to have an even smaller margin than they did after the election, which made it smaller than it was before the election.
That's right. Though I will say, you know, Cedric Richmond, he's a congressman from Louisiana, and his district is considered relatively safe for Democrats, which is why I will say I haven't heard a single Democrat really be concerned about who will pick up that seat from Cedric Richmond.
I guess one of the appointments is interesting in that it's a woman who's a lawyer who was at one time a clerk for Justice Alito on the Supreme Court, a very conservative justice. Tell us about her.
Yeah, I mean, and part of what I will say is, you know, there is a sort of a deep understanding within the Biden transition team and, you know, the incoming Biden White House that they're going to have to be operating in a climate that requires sort of understanding where, say, a conservative court may be or where a potential Senate Republican majority may be in Congress. And so there is, I think, a desire to make sure that there are folks who understand operating within that world. You know, there are what I will say to me, which was very unique about how Biden was able to win, was he built this remarkably broad coalition of voters. You had folks who were, you know, moderate former Republicans who came out to support him, who just didn't like President Trump. And then you had folks who, you know, certainly would have preferred Bernie Sanders, but ultimately decided to go for him. And really what we're beginning to see is some of the thought processes of how a Joe Biden presidency will actually govern. And what we're seeing, I don't think is a particularly huge surprise to a lot of folks, but it is a desire to have a sort of moderate centrist form of governing and a sense that he will need to work across the aisle. It's something that he's talked about, frankly, all throughout his candidacy, and it's something he continues to talk about. That all being said, he's still operating in a world where many Republicans in Congress have yet to actually acknowledge him as the president-elect.
Yeah, and in that regard, do you have any sense or has anybody given any indication that, for example, the president-elect has called Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell to check in, or when it comes to making these kinds of appointments? Now, the appointments he's been announcing the last couple of days don't require Senate confirmation, but his cabinet obviously will. Do you think we're going to see the president-elect reach out to the majority leader to say, okay, what if I nominated so-and-so for this particular cabinet position? What are my chances of confirmation? Does it work like that? Is there going to be a little bit of, backroom conversation before these nominations are announced?
Well, step one for that to actually occur would be for Mitch McConnell and Joe Biden to have a conversation. And the last we were told is that McConnell had not yet congratulated Biden as the winner. So I will say the idea of them actually having conversations about cabinet picks seems a little bit too far off in the future if at this point McConnell has yet to actually publicly acknowledge, or even frankly privately to our knowledge, acknowledge Biden as the president-elect. There has been some reporting, we have not yet confirm this, but the fact that Biden and his transition team has been thinking of actually allowing cabinet appointees, people that they are thinking to appoint to the cabinet, to speak out more in public and to have sort of a more public campaign ahead of any official confirmation process, that would be somewhat unique. But I think there is this sense that perhaps that could bring additional pressure on various Republicans in Congress to appoint the picks that Joe Biden has in mind.
Asma Khalid joins me. She is a political correspondent for NPR. She's the breakout star co-host of the NPR Politics podcast, which I'm delighted to listen to on my walks every morning. She's covered the Biden campaign. She's now covering the transition. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. So, Asma, what has the reaction of the left been to these appointments that have been noted so far, that have been announced so far? I understand that there was at least one group that opposed the appointment of Cedric Richmond.
Yeah, that's right. And I'm not sure if you're referring to the Sunrise Movement, which is a climate-oriented group of young progressive activists who came out in opposition to Cedric Richmond. My understanding was they were particularly displeased by the amount of donations he's received from Big Oil over the years. I think one of, again, the challenges for the president-elect is that he built a very broad coalition in terms of essentially defeating President Trump. But the question now for him is how he actually is able to govern with this broad coalition. It's a story that I'm working on actually at this moment as we talk. I mean, these were some of the interviews I was doing this morning. And, you know, I think that there is always a challenge of governing for any particular president-elect. Biden's challenges might be particularly sharper and more acute because he built a remarkably broad coalition. That all being said, you know, certain folks feel that they were responsible for his victory. When you have margins that are as small as they were in, say, a state like Wisconsin or potentially Georgia, a lot of different constituency groups and demographics can take credit for that victory. And everybody wants, you know, a particular favor or particular policy plan that they had pushed for to be enacted. And, you know, Biden made a lot of campaign promises all throughout the general election season. Some of those promises seem to be predicated on the belief that he would have a Democratic Senate that he would be working with. If that's not the case, you know, there are certainly sort of more bold visions, say, pushing really for comprehensive immigration reform that may be tabled for a while because it doesn't seem plausible that something like that could really go through a Republican Senate.
And in terms of the level of public comment about the lack of the Trump administration's ascertainment of the election, did you see an uptick in it yesterday? I mean, folks have long noted that it really doesn't matter whether or not Mr. Trump himself personally concedes the election. But what does matter is that the General Services Administration formally ascertain the winner, which then allows, you know, offices to be set up for the transition and allows information from various departments and agencies to be shared. Do you see that the Biden camp is ratcheting up their conversation about that and whatever pressure they can bring to bear for the Trump administration to do that?
Well, publicly, I think we've certainly seen signs that they have more concern over the delayed transition process this week than they did, say, for example, last week. Last week, in some public comments, the president-elect seemed to suggest that, you know, it would be nice. He tried to sort of maintain an upbeat attitude, suggesting it wouldn't be particularly problematic. I was with him earlier this week in Delaware, where he was again asked, you know, sort of what are the biggest challenges about this delayed, uncoordinated transition process? And he was really blunt. He said, frankly, that in his view, more people could die. And he was referring specifically to the lack of coordination around the pandemic and the lack of coordination around a possible COVID vaccine. That's additional messaging that we've heard from some of the folks within his COVID advisory task force. They held a call with reporters yesterday where they were emphasizing the fact that they need access to data. They need access to career scientists. They have not had access to that. They're relying on kind of these public COVID dashboards that, you know, those of us out here in the public, lay people, are also relying on. And so they do have concerns that if they are unable to sort of look at what these vaccine deployment plans may be, or if they're not able to talk to some of the career scientists who've been working on this now, that it might actually delay implementation of a vaccine in January or February. And the other big issue, I will say, that we hear from them is around this idea of national security, in major part because, you know, there has been some reporting about what the delayed transition process during the 2000 election meant for the 9/11 attacks. And, you know, there are certainly many folks, Democrats, even, you know, some Republicans who will acknowledge that at this point, Biden is the president-elect, and he ought to be receiving presidential daily intelligence briefings. He's not been able to receive those briefings. Yesterday, both he and the vice president-elect Kamala Harris held a kind of it was a national security briefing in lieu of a real national security briefing. So it was just with sort of former advisors who've worked in this space, but nobody, you know, who's currently in this realm who has clear access to the utmost important intelligence information, the current real-time information that Biden and Harris would need.
And of those two points that you just made, two really good points about the pandemic and national intelligence, let me take the second one first. There are those who say that because Kamala Harris, the vice president-elect, is a senator who sits on the Intel committee, she is privy to Intel briefings that the rest of the Senate is not. Is it your impression that the briefings that now still Senator Harris is getting, compensate in any way for what Mr. Biden is not getting?
Well, Biden himself did make a joke of this point earlier this week, saying that, you know, one of the good things is that his running mate still does receive those Senate intelligence briefings. I will say it's hard for me to interpret whether that is actually sufficient. What I will say is I hear a lot from Democrats that they feel Biden needs to be getting the same president special intelligence briefings that Donald Trump does, that any other president-elect historically has gotten. I think the comments we've heard from Biden pointing out that Senator Harris does receive these briefings is an indication of just his overall upbeat, optimistic attitude about this entire delayed transition process. You know, he has tried from the outset of his candidacy to talk about the fact that he was trying to bring back civility and dignity to this job. And despite, I would say, some of the impediments of this delayed transition process, we've heard more gripes and complaints about this process from other Democrats, frankly, folks who aren't even on the transition committee, as well as some very real concerns from folks within the transition world, more so than we've heard from Joe Biden himself directly, at least to date.
And to go back to the pandemic, you mentioned that you and I and anybody who listens to NPR or looks at the New York Times or the Atlantic Magazine or the Johns Hopkins dashboard, we do have a lot of information about COVID-19. I wonder, do you have any sense, and do the Biden people tell you, that there are specific things that they don't have? They are relying on public data. Do you have any notion of what's in the private data? What's in the data that they don't have access to that differs? And if so, how it differs from the public data? I mean, why they are clearly concerned about it. And do you have any insight as to why that concern is so acute?
Sure. I mean, my understanding is the top concern is about coordinating an effective vaccine delivery plan. That is something that we've heard from a number of folks within the COVID advisory task force. And I would say they feel like that is a more imminent concern, in part because we've seen, you know, positive results from two pharmaceutical companies, Moderna and Pfizer, recently suggesting that that they could very quickly have a vaccine that is ready for deployment. And so my understanding is that Biden transition team, you know, the would-be Biden White House, does not have access to folks who have been working on the coordinated vaccine deployment plans within the current administration. And so they don't have a sense of that. My understanding is also they don't have a sense, for example, around specific testing information or PPE, you know, deployment to various states. But really, the point I keep hearing about consistently is about an effective vaccine deployment. They have said for months that they have concerns that the issue is not just a vaccine. A vaccine, in their view, is only as good as people's ability to actually get vaccinated. And they felt like it was going to be a particular challenge to ensure, you know, some over 300 million Americans would actually be able to get the vaccine in a fairly efficient manner.
And are any people in the Biden campaign speculating, or do they have any notion or even inside information about when President Trump might allow the GSA to ascertain the election? Are they even prepared for a scenario in which the president never allows the GSA to ascertain the election? I mean, he's been tweeting like crazy over the last couple of weeks. I signed up for these tweets, and I get one about every 8 or 9 minutes. I'm sure you get them too, asking for money to fight the legal fight so that the Democrats don't steal the election. We hear this over and over again from the Trump camp and from Mr. Trump himself. Is there any notion among the Biden folks as to what the president's endgame is here and when this might stop?
Well, I will say, I talked to our folks who cover the White House, who cover the Trump administration. I don't think anybody has a clear sense of exactly what President Trump's endgame is, in part because he's a rather unpredictable politician. That all being said, a number of folks that I've talked to who have covered his administration say that they're not certain that he will officially ever concede. It's just not part of his personality. That all being said, there's sort of a distinction we should make here between GSA ascertainment and President Trump's concession. Now, he is not required to concede, and in all likelihood, it's possible that he may never concede. But my understanding is the ascertainment will happen once officially states certify the results and once the Electoral College will vote. So that is a process that will happen with or without President Trump's desire for it to happen. It is an inevitable process. The issue is just that the ascertainment, you know, could certainly happen a lot quicker if the President Trump current White House administration was on board with acknowledging Joe Biden and Kamala Harris as the vice president, I'm sorry, as the president-elect and the vice president-elect.
And certification then we would expect to happen sometime like second week of December or something like that?
Yeah, I mean, it depends on certain states. I'm sure, you know, some of the listeners might have heard some of the news out of Michigan. There was a big brouhaha last night where Wayne County, which is the county where Detroit is located, had a lot of back and forth over some election officials, Republican election officials, not wanting to certify results from within the city of Detroit. Again, sort of falsely accusing folks there of fraud. There was no indication of any such fraud. Eventually, those results were certified. But I think it raised a lot of alarm bells for folks over the ability for these election results to be very, very partisan. And frankly, for folks to poke holes in election results that are completely, entirely legitimate, but sort of suggesting that they are, for whatever reason, illegitimate.
So President-elect Biden won the election by more than 5 million votes in the popular count, receiving more votes than any president before him. And Mr. Trump received the second highest number of votes in history. The Electoral College victory, exactly as substantial this time as it was when Mr. Trump was elected back in 2016. Do the Biden folks go into their administration thinking that they have a clear mandate? I mean, Mr. Biden did talk and, in fact, ran the central premise of his campaign was we want to unite the country. Does that mean that he treads cautiously in his first, few months in particular? Or do you think that they are seeing the size of the victory and the popular vote as, in fact, a clear mandate to overturn and erase many of the things that Mr. Trump did during his time in office, the way Trump erased many of the things Mr. Obama did? I mean, what's their frame of reference and their frame of mind about what they have been empowered by the voters to do?
You know, I will say, I think a mandate is kind of a sort of fickle concept for how different politicians decide how far they want to go on a particular concept. I mean, President Trump by no means had a mandate, right? His victory in 2016 is smaller than the victory that Joe Biden is looking at, and yet he certainly governed from the outset, you know, enacting things like a, you know, so-called Muslim travel ban pretty much the week after he was inaugurated. It was a campaign promise that he fulfilled via executive order, and he certainly governed in the immediate sense, and I would say for a while, with the assumption that he had a clear mandate. And so to me, this word or this concept of having a mandate is sort of is a politically squishy word that I think depends more and is more indicative of the particular politician's behavior versus an actual real concrete sense of widespread approval, whether that's, you know, something we see from the popular vote or the Electoral College vote. What I will say is I think, again, Biden is having to thread a very, very fine line. He has spoken about bipartisanship and unity extensively. It is still something we hear him sound. You know, he this week was praising certain Republican governors who've enacted mask mandates, like I believe the governor of Ohio, Mike DeWine. So he has this desire to try to find common ground. That being said, the night that he declared victory in his sort of victory speech there out in Delaware, he did actually, to my knowledge, use the word mandate. I mean, he spoke about the fact that he did feel like they had an alleged mandate to enact certain policy visions, policy ideas he had campaigned on. You know, what will be perhaps the most, I think, important upcoming factor, though, as to how he is able to govern and what steps he is able to take, depend on two things. One is notably who controls the Senate, and I don't know that we'll have a clear, definitive sense of that, obviously, until January when the Georgia runoffs occur. But secondly, it's an issue of really when and how we actually see Republicans acknowledge Joe Biden as the president-elect. I mean, it's really hard to talk about and continue to speak about bipartisanship and unity when most of the Republicans in the Senate have yet to publicly acknowledge Biden as the president-elect. And certainly, as a result of that, Biden will continue to face pressure from all corners, specifically folks on the more progressive left, to govern by executive order. Now, whether or not that's really in Biden's nature, you know, that is debatable. But I would say he's certainly going to face a lot of pressure to behave that way as Republicans maybe do not, you know, acknowledge him as the legitimate winner for a bit.
Asma Khalid is covering the presidential transition. She's a political correspondent for NPR and a co-host of the NPR Politics podcast. Asma, thank you for your insight today and for your terrific reporting throughout the campaign and continuing through the transition. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Coming up, Baltimore County's plans for reopening schools. Dr. Daryl Williams, the superintendent of Baltimore County Schools, joins me on the other side of this quick break. I'm Tom Hall. It's midday. Stay with us.
You're listening to your NPR news station, 88.1 WYPR.